I'm Mike Collins. Join Charlotte Talks as we take our local news roundup across the border to South Carolina on Friday, February 28th. We'll broadcast live from Amelie's in Rock Hill. We'll talk about the South Carolina primary and the top Charlotte stories of the week. For information, go to WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. At one point, about 30 years after the Civil War, Wilmington, North Carolina had become a shining example of the progress formerly enslaved people could make if given the opportunity. But it was the fact of that opportunity that resulted in an act of violence coupled with something rare in the United States, a bloody coup staged by a group of white supremacists, forced black officials from office at gunpoint. 60 African Americans died in a battle that was labeled as and believed for years to be a race riot. The action was led by prominent citizens, including the editor of the state's largest newspaper. It reversed all of the gains made by African Americans and enshrined racism as official government policy for another half century. That story is told in Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Zucchino's new book, Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. And he joins us for the hour. Thank you for being here. Welcome to Charlotte.
Great to be with you, Mike.
You're welcome. David Zucchino is in town for an event at First Baptist Church West tonight at 6:30. It's sponsored by QCityMetro.com. They'd like you to register for that, and we have details on our website at WFAE.org. You've worked as a foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya, for the Philadelphia Inquirer. You were in Beirut and Nairobi and Johannesburg, Chechnya, the former Yugoslavia for the New York Times. You were awarded the Pulitzer Prize after previous nominations for your work in South Africa. So how does this book about Wilmington in 1898 figure into any of that?
It just struck me as this amazing, fascinating, improbable story. And I grew up in North Carolina and went to college here, and I had never heard of this until about 20 years ago. And when I did hear about it, I said, this couldn't have possibly happened in the United States. Somebody needs to tell this story. And the story had been told by academics. In the academic world, it was known, but it was not known to the general public and certainly wasn't known across the United States. So once I heard about this, I just kind of tucked it away and say, someday I'm going to write a book about this because this really needs to be told. And I finally got the time, and here we are.
You say it was told by, it was known by academics, academics have written about it, but the textbooks in North Carolina, which are written by academics in many cases, one would hope, didn't reflect the news, and people don't know it. This is a significant event. Why did nobody know it?
Yeah, this is a major event, not only in North Carolina history, but in American history.
Yeah.
And there was a concerted attempt to bury it, to cover it up, not talk about it, and that lasted for well over 100 years. Now, early on, the white supremacists who mounted this this coup and massacre were quite proud of it, talked about it, boasted about it, and came up with a narrative. You know, the cliche is that victors write history, and they wrote the history.
Yeah.
And they portrayed this as a black race riot, and also as a town, Wilmington, that was run by incompetent African-American officials who were venal and corrupt and oppressed white citizens, and it had to be removed. And at the same time, they were plotting, they were stockpiling arms, and they were supposedly going to rise up during the election in the fall of 1898 and take over the city and kill all the whites. That was completely false, but that was the narrative that they crafted to explain, well, that's why we had to rise up, overthrow the government, and unfortunately we had to kill 60-some black men. But after these men passed away, then the story was buried, and it was barely told in the school textbooks, but when it was told, it was this narrative yeah. that this was a victory for a good white men's government.
And it was a black riot perpetrated by black people, and so it had to be put down.
Correct.
Is it true that this is the only instance of a political coup in which a duly elected government has been overthrown in the United States of America?
It could be. It depends on how you define coup. A lot of historians define coup as some of these stolen elections across the South after Reconstruction, and this was one of them.
One of them,
in 1898, it was stolen. So in some ways, those are considered coups. But to my mind, it is the only pre-planned, premeditated, violent overthrow of an elected government in American history.
And usually with a coup, military is involved. And in fact, there were two or three, I've forgotten how many it's in your book, state militias.
Yes.
And this was kind of an ex officio military attack on this government.
There was a military campaign on two fronts. The white supremacists had their own vigilantes, and these were called red shirts.
Right.
This was an outgrowth of the Klan. It was basically vigilantes, white men, and their job during the summer and fall of 1898, preceding the election, was to ride through the Cape Fear countryside on horseback with Winchesters and shotguns and pistols, break into black houses at night, pull African-American men out, beat them and whip them and tell them, if you dare register to vote, we will come back and kill you. And they were able to suppress the black vote. Secondly, there were the state militias that you mentioned. It was the Wilmington Light Infantry and the Naval Reserves. These were the National Guard of the day in Wilmington, mm-hmm. supposed to report to the governor in Raleigh. In fact, they were commanded by white supremacists, made up of white supremacists, and took their orders from the coup plotters. So they had these two different military arms that they used to suppress the black vote.
The red shirts. Were they affiliated with the Ku Klux Klan, or were they the Klan? Or this is a different name. Why not just the Klan?
Because the Klan had been run out of Wilmington in 1868 by a black man named Abraham Galloway, who was sort of the leader of black resistance right after the Civil War. He was an escaped slave who had become a Union spy and then became the first black man to serve as a state senator. In 1868, there was a constitutional election. Every southern state had to write a new constitution. There was an election in which blacks for the first time were able to vote. Mm-hmm. The Ku Klux Klan in Wilmington made it their business to keep black men from voting and intimidated them and beat them. And this man, Abraham Galloway, raised a black militia that drove the Klan out of Wilmington. Mm-hmm. And they did not appear on the streets of Wilmington until the 1920s. But by the 1890s, their sons and grandsons and nephews regrouped as the Red Shirts. But essentially, it was the Klan with the same goal of suppressing the black vote and intimidating black men.
We're living through a period right now where facts don't seem to matter, or a period in which my facts are as good as your facts, even if your facts are based in science and mine are not. And we hear all the time these days about fake news. And we think this is a new phenomenon. Clearly, it is not. These are the tactics that they used back then.
Absolutely. There was a propaganda campaign, and it was led by Josephus Daniels, who was the editor of the News and Observer in Raleigh, at that time the state's most powerful and influential newspaper. And he would plant phony stories, one about the so-called black beast rapist, and that was the term they used. Any incidental contact between a black man and a white woman suddenly became a scandal and a rape, and he would play up these stories. At the same time, he would run phony stories of supposed corruption by black officials in Wilmington, because Wilmington at the time was very unusual. It had a multiracial government,
right,
which was extremely rare in the South at that time, and it also had a black majority.
How did that happen?
That happened because after the Civil War, Wilmington was the biggest city in the state, the most important city in the state. It was the last Confederate port to fall during the Civil War, a very important city. There were lots of jobs. There was cotton. There was the naval stores industry, tar and turpentine from the pine forest there. There were jobs at the port. So freed slaves just poured into Wilmington, and they created, over 30 years, a very strong black middle class. There were black professionals, doctors and lawyers and magistrates, and it was a very thriving African-American town with as I say, a very unusual multiracial government. Three of the 10 city councilmen were black, and 10 of the 26 policemen were black, and there were black judges. And this was more than the white supremacists could bear, and they were determined to wipe that out.
I want to get back to this fake news thing.
Yes.
Where the editor, what was his name, Josephus Daniels, editor of the News and Observer, the largest newspaper in the state, most influential media. That was the media back
yes.
then. Willfully put lies, wrote stories that were completely fabricated. How rare is that? How rare was it then? How rare is it now?
It wasn't rare then. and in fact, he coordinated other white newspapers, and all the main newspapers were white. There was a black press at that time,
right.
But the white newspapers, there were three main newspapers in Wilmington, all run by white supremacists. And so they were all part of this fake news campaign. So it was very common then. I read through so many of these old newspapers, and the style of writing was so different
right.
than it is now. It was very florid and very personal. They didn't cite facts. They just gave their opinions. And you can see some of that today, particularly on social media and on Twitter. As you say, we all have our own facts. So there was nothing new then and nothing new now about fake news.
The fact that Wilmington had this this enormous participation for the time of African-American individuals in government, in business, in professional positions, gave Wilmington in 1898 the moniker, the freest town for a Negro in the country.
Yes.
And all of that went away overnight.
Instantly, yes. And it was planned for months, though. It was planned during the spring, summer, and fall of 1898. And that's what struck me about this when I first heard about this, is how well planned it was and how orchestrated it was. They even set the date for the day of the coup. There was an election in November, but that was only for county, state, and federal offices. The city offices weren't up for re-election until March, and they said, well, we're not going to wait for that. We are going to steal the election through intimidation and fraud, and then 2 days later, from a new position of power and strength, we are going to overthrow the government, and they did.
You know, I don't know about you, but I grew up thinking that America was fair, and we wore white hats, and we did what was right, and then you hear stories like this, and you learn more about our past, and you understand that that's a myth. It was never true. How should we regard this? Because I'm sure some of the same stuff goes on right now.
Exactly, and you would think back then and today that the federal government would step in.
I was going to ask about that. Didn't they?
Well, in 1898. there was a man named George Henry White, mm-hmm. and he was an African-American man who represented a district in southeastern North Carolina, abutting Wilmington. He was the only African-American member of Congress at the time, in the entire country. There was one.
Yeah.
He warned President McKinley, William McKinley, before the coup, because the coup leaders announced it. They told everybody, and in fact, all the white newspapers sent their white reporters down during the spring and summer and fall to cover it. So it was well known. They said they were going to win by the ballot or the bullet or both. They said we're going to need violence, and we don't mind using violence. George Henry White, the congressman, met with McKinley in the White House before the coup and said this is going to happen. You have to do something. A group of black ministers from Washington also met with him. And then after the coup, the same thing. George Henry White and the ministers met with McKinley. I could find no record that he ever uttered one word in public about the coup and certainly did nothing about it. He didn't send troops. He didn't indict anybody. He didn't do anything.
So again, these public admissions of we're going to do this or we've done this, we've committed this heinous crime, this too is not new.
No.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We're going to explore what happened in Wilmington in 1898 in greater detail as we go through the hour with David Sacchino, the author of Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898, and the Rise of White Supremacy. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with David Zucchino. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and reporter for The New York Times. He has written a book called Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. If you're just joining us, you probably didn't know much about this because in your history books, it's portrayed as a black riot that had to be put down by righteous white people to protect the sanctity of white womanhood and other things that you've heard about in the antebellum South, when in fact the absolute reverse is true. It was a military, it was a military coup against the duly elected government, and 60 black men died as a result of that. These folks, these black people who came into power in 1898 following Reconstruction through being duly elected by the population of Wilmington and then took positions as doctors and lawyers and other professions. You say that Negroes, and I use the word Negro because that is how they were referred to in the time, that Negroes both benefited and aided Republican victories at the polls. And this is what angered these white supremacists who just was, they were not going to put up with it. And we got an email yesterday from one of our listeners in advance of this asking me to, quote, please not forget to mention that the racists, rebels that perpetrated this overthrow of duly elected officials were Democrats, Jim Crow Democrats who ruled the South for decades. I'm not sure why he wanted me to point that out, but unless he equates today's Democrats and today's Republicans with those of that time period, but they aren't, in fact, the same parties.
No.
They have completely flip-flopped on their, their belief system. And that happened sometime early in the 20th century, certainly by the mid-20th century.
Yes.
And it was those Democrats who launched what they called their white supremacy campaign. So you've alluded to this. This was truly orchestrated. What was that campaign? Was it just this coup, or was there more to it than that?
It was a statewide campaign focused on Wilmington because Wilmington was the biggest and most important city, and it had this unusual arrangement known as fusion, in which blacks and whites were in government, and blacks, as you say, had an important economic role. But the campaign was more than that. It was run out of Raleigh by Josephus Daniels, the editor of the News and Observer, and by a man named Fernfold Simmons, who was the head of the Democratic Party. And as most of your listeners know, at that time, the Democrats were the party of white supremacy, and the Republicans were the party of Lincoln and black suffrage. The black vote helped put Republicans in power and in Raleigh and in Wilmington through this process known as fusion, which combined poor white farmers of the Populist Party who had undergone a terrible recession in the early 1890s. And they had been aligned with the Democrats, but decided the Democrats had abandoned them and weren't talking about pocketbook issues. So they made this unusual decision to align themselves with white and black Republicans. These were poor white farmers who were probably as racist as any of the white supremacist Democrats, but for their own economic interest, align themselves with black voters. And because you had the white populists and the black Republicans and the white Republicans, they were able to gain power not only in state legislature, but in Wilmington. So this white supremacy campaign was mounted to keep black men from voting ever again and to keep black men from ever again holding public office. That was the overall goal of the campaign, and it just worked brilliantly from their point of view.
So white supremacists owned the newspapers, and
yes.
Josephus Daniels, editor of the most powerful newspaper at the time, the Raleigh News and Observer, not only used his newspaper to perpetrate these falsehoods about black people and to incite the anger and hatred and fear in white people, he orchestrated this. He's the conductor. He's the mastermind. Is that right?
Yes, he was. He portrayed himself as a journalist. He was actually a politician who happened to own a newspaper. He was on the executive committee of the Democratic Party. They held Democratic Party meetings in Daniel's newspaper office, and the Democrats would decide what the editorial policy would be that day and which people they would attack. So he was a politician. And
who went on to serve in the Senate, right? The United States Senate?
He was Secretary of the Navy under Woodrow Wilson. He was an ambassador to Mexico later on. But to show you how well thought out this was, almost 25% of the white population was illiterate. So they couldn't read the newspapers. So Daniels hired a political cartoonist to draw these race-baiting cartoons that perpetrated these same myths about the black beast rapists and so on. And that allowed 25% of the white population to understand the core tenets of white supremacy and what it was all about. So that just shows you how well planned and orchestrated this campaign was.
I'm sure the lines are blurred, because I'm sure if you have white supremacist tendencies and you run the most powerful media organization in the state and you're feeding that beast of a newspaper every day with things that are not true, that it's hard to tell when the plan for this coup actually began, because it blurs into everything else. But have you been able to determine how long it took them to plan this?
Yeah, it started in March of that year. Fernifold Simmons, the chairman of the Democratic Party, and Josephus Daniels met in New Bern to plot the strategy, and they came up with a Democratic Party handbook, which still exists today, and it laid out the tenets of white supremacy, and it said North Carolina was a white man state and white men will rule it. Never again will Negroes hold office or vote. They can stay here, but they must obey us. And they printed this and handed it out to all across the state, printed it in the newspapers, printed it as a handbook to pass out. So you can start the beginning of this particular white supremacy campaign in March of that year, culminating in November with the massacre and the coup.
So they were telling their readers in that newspaper and others around the state that black people were plotting to kill white people, they were going to kill white women and children, and they were going to take over the city of Wilmington and burn down the white businesses. And in fact, that was projection.
Yes.
The exact opposite was true. And you're a newspaper man. How many times in our history do you think this kind of thing has happened, where the exact opposite of what the truth is being published and designed by the publisher or the editor to be that way? Because trust in media today is very low.
Yes.
I think we went through a period following the early 20th century where yellow journalism was rampant. I think that we went through a period where it became fairly, except for the editorial pages, fairly fair. Is that a myth, too?
Well, I would say today in the so-called the mass media, the conventional media, the newspapers, I think still make the separation between the editorial page and the news page. They cite their sources. Stories are carefully edited for the facts. But we also have this explosion on the internet, through Twitter and through social media, where you get to pick the news you want. You can curate your own news, so you can only hear opinions and news that fits your political views and your expectations. And we have this outbreak of fake news. Donald Trump calls it fake news and blames it on the mainstream media, and that's another example of projection, when in fact it's the Twitterverse and the social media people and Fox News that perpetrate their own version of the facts.
It's hard to make a direct comparison, I suppose, but because the times have changed and media outlets and new media have come into being, and back then, newspapers were fundamentally controlled by white people because they had all the money. There were black papers. We're going to talk about the black paper in Wilmington in a second. But the big kahunas were these white newspapers, and they, in the South at least, had a similar point of view, particularly with regard to race relations. Today, we have the Washington Post and the Washington Times, allegedly on either side of the same coin. And then you have, in the electronic world, you have Fox News and MSNBC.
Right.
Can you equate how they operate and the messages they send out in our modern day to what was going out then?
Well, I can give you an example right from the White House. In 1898, there was a man named Alex Manley, who was the publisher, the black publisher of the Daily Record, the black newspaper in Wilmington. He received many, many death threats, but he was also told repeatedly to go back to Africa. just this summer, you had three U.S. citizens, congresswomen of color, told by the President of the United States to go back to their home countries. In 1898, white voters were warned that black men were coming to rape their women and take their jobs. When Donald Trump came down that escalator in 2015, he announced that Mexican criminals and, quote, rapists, that's the term he used, were pouring across the border to take American jobs. So you see this same theme of incitement, playing to racial hatreds, playing to resentments, still playing out 122 years later.
Is this an American phenomenon? You've been all over the world, and you've covered stories in the Middle East, etc. Is this an American phenomenon, or is this just human nature?
Not at all. Not at all. And I've seen it on religious grounds in Lebanon, ethnic grounds in Afghanistan and Iraq, also ethnic and religion. It's everywhere.
Do those countries tell themselves that they're the knight in shining armor like we do?
Their group is. You know, their ethnic group or their religious group is the right way, and the other side is duplicitous and evil and needs to be destroyed. I mean, I've seen that particularly in Afghanistan and Iraq, Libya, places like that, Chechnya.
Let's talk about some of the figures. We've talked a little bit about Josephus Daniels, who was the editor of the Raleigh News and Observer. Before we move on, let me ask you this, because you worked at the Raleigh News and Observer. Is this something that people around the newsroom or around that newspaper talk about, or is this just buried in that's ancient history, that was a time, a different era, different ownership, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, that was my first job out of journalism school, was okay. At the News and Observer. When you walk into the building, at that time, there was a bust of Josephus Daniels in the lobby. There were mementos all around the newsroom as this crusading journalist, this wonderful man. I worked there almost 5 years. Not once did anybody mention, oh, by the way, he was the leader of the white supremacy campaign. He was this fervid white supremacist. I never knew that. I didn't know that until many, many years later. I can give you another example. I went to UNC. I was given, as a freshman, assigned to Morrison Dorm. I didn't know who this guy Morrison was. Somebody said, he was a North Carolina governor. Years later, as I'm researching this book, he's a character in my book. He is one of the orators out on the campaign trail, one of the leading white supremacists of his day. And in fact, his performance during the white supremacy campaign got him elected governor. There were three governors elected from the white supremacy campaign. So that just shows you how this was buried. I didn't know any of that, and I think most people don't know that.
David Cicchino is our guest. He is the author of Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and The Rise of White Supremacy. There was a guy named Alexander Lightfoot Manley, and he owned and edited the Daily Record. That's the black newspaper in Wilmington at the time. You write that he passed for white, and in fact, his paternal grandfather was North Carolina Governor Charles Manley.
Yes.
Isn't that interesting? And he wrote an editorial in response to a speech that had been made in Georgia. And I think you have a passage in your book that illustrates what that editorial was like.
Yes, let me set it up real quickly. This woman, Rebecca Felton, in Georgia, gave a speech talking about a supposed epidemic of rapes of white women by black men, and she said the only solution was the lynch rope, and her quote was, "I say lynch 1,000 times a week if necessary." This was printed everywhere in the Wilmington papers. Alex Manley saw it, and he said, "I am going to respond." He responded that day with an editorial that said essentially many of the black men who were lynched for supposedly raping white women were in fact consensual lovers of the white women, and secondly, white men for years had been raping black women with impunity. So he writes this editorial in its address to the white supremacists of Wilmington, and let me just read a couple lines from it. Quote, "Every Negro lynched is called a, quote, big, burly, black brute, when in fact many of those who have thus been dealt with had white men for their fathers and were not only black and burly, but were sufficiently attractive for white girls of culture and refinement to fall in love with them, as is very well known to all. Let virtue be something more than an excuse for them to intimidate and torture a helpless people. Tell your men that it is no worse for a black man to be intimate with a white woman than for a white man to be intimate with a colored woman. You set yourselves down as a lot of carping hypocrites in that you cry aloud for the virtue of your women while you seek to destroy the morality of ours."
Wow. Was that brave or was that stupid? Was that an illustration of how comfortable and secure people felt in Wilmington because it was the freest place for Negroes in America?
I think it was incredibly courageous at this time when black men were being dragged out of their houses. And
yes.
He had been threatened with death, told to go back to Africa, and yet he summoned the courage to write this editorial. And in fact, that very day, the red shirts, the vigilantes, mounted up a lynch posse to go get Manley and lynch him. And to show you how premeditated this was, the leaders of the white supremacy campaign said, no, not now. This is August. We need to wait till closer till the election in November to have greater political impact. So they stopped the lynching party.
Was this the catalyst for that, or had plans already been underway?
Oh, plans were long underway, but in retrospect, the white supremacists pointed to this editorial as, see, this is proof that black men were rapists and coming for our women, and this is proof that we had to overthrow this illegitimate government, even though this happened in August and the coup wasn't until November.
Another key figure was Alfred Moore Waddell, who was, a leading orator of the times, and he kept extolling the, quote, necessity of white supremacy. And he, too, helped engineer this coup. What was his role?
He was a former Confederate officer, former congressman, a lawyer who had fallen on hard times and was considered a has-been, but with the white supremacy campaign, he just found a new reason for being. He was a great orator and started giving these blood-curdling speeches on the campaign trail, inciting white men to attack black men to keep them from voting. He really, really knew how to talk to the red shirts and to get them riled up. And on the night before the election in November of 1898, he gave a stirring speech to about 1,000 whooping and cheering, gun-toting red shirts in Thalian Hall, which is still there today, which is one of the main buildings in downtown Wilmington. So this is a quote from his speech to the red shirts.
You have about a minute.
Men, the crisis is upon us. You must do your duty. This city, county, and state shall be rid of Negro domination once and forever. You have the courage. You are brave. You are the sons of noble ancestry. You are Anglo-Saxons. You are armed and prepared, and you will do your duty. Go to the polls tomorrow, and if you find the Negro out voting, tell him to leave the polls. And if he refuses, kill him. Shoot him down in his tracks.
Wow. Let's erect a statue to him, shall we?
Yeah.
We're going to take a break. We're going to come right back with more of this story about Wilmington in 1898, Wilmington's lie, the murderer's coup of 1898, and the rise of white supremacy. That's the name of David Zucchino, our guest's book. We'll take a break and come with more. Come back with more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a momentous occasion in American history that nobody knows about. Wilmington's lie, the murderous coup of 1898 and the rise of white supremacy, a moment in time in which the best place in America for African Americans to live became the worst place in America for African Americans to live overnight, it seems, but not true because they planned this for a long time. I have not invited people necessarily to join this conversation, but they have, and you can do that through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. David Zucchino is our guest. He's the author of that book. Nicole emails, my son, a freshman at Western Carolina University, just learned this in his history class. He was shocked that having grown up in North Carolina public schools, he had never heard of this before. Adding to his outrage about this is the fact that several of those white supremacists have public schools named after them. This needs to change. I'm grateful to the author for shining a light on the dark part of our state's history, and I hope it leads to some changes. And Jay emails, lots of blame on American textbooks. Are the textbook people in cahoots? Or they just don't know about this.
Well, they were written at the time by white supremacists.
Yeah, but I mean, the textbooks today are they're new.
Oh, yeah, today.
It didn't stop in 1898.
No.
So they're being written today.
Yes, and I've researched that, and the textbooks today barely mention it, and when they do, it's as a summary, and they still call it a race riot. But they don't talk about the long-term ramifications or the planning of it and the premeditated nature of it. I've given a lot of book talks around North Carolina, and I've had several public school teachers come up to me and say, this is not in our curriculum, and it's barely in our textbook, but I teach it. I think it's important, and yeah. I think people need to know. And so they're teaching it on their own.
There were a lot of lies being told us as we have laid the groundwork for, and it resulted in Democratic victories in the state legislature, but not in Wilmington. Why not? Because a lot of white supremacists had taken over the legislature. Why didn't it happen in the city government of Wilmington?
The election for the city government wasn't until 2 days later. Okay. They weren't part of the statewide and federal elections, and so they had the plan that we're going to win and steal the election, which they did, and then we're going to plan the coup for 2 days later. So this was all planned, and on the morning of November 10th, 2 days after the election, Alfred Moore Waddell, the colonel, got together a group of red shirts and went to, as they had promised, to let the red shirts burn the black newspaper, which they did. Alex Manley, meanwhile, had been warned by a white friend that a lynch mob was after him, and 2 days earlier he had fled Wilmington. This white man gave him $25 in gold coins and the password you needed, because this was a military occupation zone set by the red shirts where they had checkpoints that you had to have a password to get through them. But the fact that he looked like a white man, he had the password, he got through, and they even gave him a gun, saying, if you see this guy Manley up there, shoot him, and they gave him a Winchester. But after they burned, on the morning of November 10th, after they burned the newspaper, then they set out searching for black men to kill in the streets. And as we said earlier, they killed at least 60 black men, just shot them down, chased them through the streets. By the end of the day, they had confronted the elected government at gunpoint and forced them to resign. And the coup leaders were installed in their place. Waddell installed himself as mayor. The people who had been running through the streets killing black men became city councilmen. One of them was the police chief, and so on down the line. All the positions in city government were taken over by white supremacists.
And to the victors belong the spoils. And in an era where you could, there was no instantaneous communication. There's no cell phone video of this. No dash cam video of this. You could paint your own story. Write your own story. And that's why it has been portrayed ever since as a black race riot that had to be quelled.
Yes.
But on election day, 2 days prior to that, they really did a number on the election. They stuffed the ballot box. And in one instance, you write that there were 100 more ballots cast than there were registered voters in that precinct. Why didn't that come to somebody's attention? Clearly, everybody was in on this.
Yes. And unfortunately, the newspapers were all controlled by white supremacists, not only in Wilmington, but across the state. So they portrayed it as this wonderful victory. And the headline said, Negroism defunct.
So if you can go in and successfully stuff the ballot box, rig the election, perpetrate election fraud, why do you need to quell these people with guns? You've already taken over the government illegally through ballot box stuffing.
Correct, but the fusionist government, blacks and whites, mm-hmm. were still in positions of power in the city council.
Would have been till March.
And
just do it again.
They weren't about to wait for that. And
why
that,
not?
They had planned this, and they said, well, we can't stuff ballot boxes because the election isn't until March, so we'll just kill them. We'll confront them at gunpoint and force them to step down. And they had a banishment campaign where they listed 50 black and white leaders, the blacks they didn't kill, the most important politicians, and on the black side, the professional class. They named them, they rounded them up, they took them to the train station on the same day, mm-hmm. Put them on the trains and said, if you ever come to Wilmington again, we will shoot you on sight. And not one of them ever came back, not one of them.
Wow. Many of them, though, hid in the woods.
Yes.
And the swamps. What happened to them?
This was early in the day when the red shirts went through town shooting black men. As you can imagine, this terrified black families. They didn't know what to do. All they could think of was just to flee the city. Yeah. So hundreds of families in November, and it was cold. It was a sort of a day like today. It was cold and wet. They went to the swamps, and particularly to a black cemetery where they thought the white men wouldn't go. They spent 2 nights and 3 days there shivering in the cold. A black minister who wrote an account of it said at least one child died of exposure. These people are out just terrified. They couldn't take it anymore, and they came back after these 3 days, came to the houses just long enough to pack up what they could and get on the trains and get out of Wilmington. 2,100 African-Americans in the days and the weeks after the coup fled Wilmington and never came back.
Yeah, Wilmington went from being very quickly the freest town for a Negro in the country to a place where Negroes knew they were not welcomed and, in fact, were in grave danger. The black population in 1898, before the coup, was 56%.
Today it's 18%.
18%. And the perpetrators, the thousands of black people voted in 1898. Only five voted in 1900.
Isn't that remarkable? In 1896, there were 126,000 black men registered to vote. That's a lot of people.
Yes.
By 1902, 6 years later, there were 6,000. This was so successful that black citizens did not vote in any appreciable numbers from 1898 until the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. That's 70 years when black people were disenfranchised in this state, and it was a direct result of the white supremacy campaign of 1898.
And the perpetrators of this, who drove these African Americans from power and from their homes and who perpetrated voter fraud or election fraud, the perpetrators then started an official inquest into the victims of the violence, which held that unarmed black citizens and not armed white mobs were responsible for this riot. They investigated the victim. Sound familiar?
Yes. It's blame the victim. That's exactly what happened then. And this inquest was, I mean, if it wasn't so tragic, it would be hilarious the way they set it up. And the conclusion was, well, these black men died at the hands of perpetrators who are unknown. And, of course, everybody knew exactly who did it. But that was the conclusion, and they just washed their hands of it.
The white supremacists, as you said, made no bones about this. They didn't hide the fact that this was coming, that they were planning to do this, that they felt the way they felt, and this was going to be the result, and their way of taking back rightfully the power that belonged to them and not to black people. And they said they were going to take power back by the ballot or the bullet or both. That didn't serve as a warning shot across the bow for African Americans in Wilmington. This came as a surprise to them on the 2 days after Election Day.
They were not surprised at all. And as I was writing this book, I obviously knew how it turned out, but I had this sense of dread as I was going through the spring, summer, and fall and writing about it and wondering what it must have been like to be an African American at that time, because they knew it was coming. It was like this boulder coming down the hill, and they could see it, and they didn't know how to get out of the way. And Alex Manley, the black editor, even a few days before the election, said, listen, there's been all this blood-curdling talk and all this talk of violence, but really, I don't think they would really do this. These are our neighbors. And so he kind of calmed everybody, and they said, yeah, you're right. This is too crazy. This would never happen.
This is how it happens,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah.
This is the frog in the pot of boiling water, and you don't realize you're going to be scalded to death until it's too late. And
exactly.
This has happened repeatedly in human history. Why don't we see this? Why don't we learn from the past?
I think you just don't want to believe that horrible things are going to happen. You just believe in the goodness of human nature. I know these people are talking this way, but surely they can't mean it. They're just blowing off steam. I think it's difficult for people to confront horror, even though it's right in front of their face. And it was just tragic, you know, reading about the experiences of African Americans during this time.
What happened to Manley, the black newspaper editor?
Manley, as I said, did escape a couple of days before the election, went to Philadelphia, and became one of the leading citizens of Philadelphia. He organized an organization that helped young black men fleeing from the South to teach them industrial jobs. He became a speaker, a well-known figure, and a well-respected man for the rest of his life. But he never once went back to Wilmington. He was too afraid.
Oh, yeah, why would he? Why would anybody go back, to Wilmington? There's another figure in here. I'm trying to... Here he is. William Everett Henderson, a Wilmington lawyer who lived as a black man but was actually the son of a white man and a Cherokee woman, a respected leader among blacks. You say he was banished from Wilmington at gunpoint after the coup. So you have Manley, who could pass for white and whose father was a governor of North Carolina, obviously a white man, and this guy who looked black or lived as a black man, but it was actually not.
Right.
How do you explain that?
He made the decision, as Manley did, I am going to live as a proud black man. And both of them, if you look at their picture, they could have easily, quote, passed, because a lot of mixed race people did that. It was to their advantage. They could avoid a lot of pain and suffering. Both of these men courageously said, I am a black man. William Henderson was a lawyer, and he represented black clients in court against this oppressive white legal system, and it was not black domination, as the newspaper said. It was completely controlled by the whites. He rallied blacks to stand up to the whites, and that's why he was targeted for banishment on the night of the coup. The 50 red shirts burst into his house when his wife and his kids were sleeping there. He tried to hold them off. They said, you got to leave right now, and they pointed guns at him, and he negotiated, said, give me another day, and then you got 24 hours. He had to close down his law office, sell his house, pack up his family, and get out, and he did. He left and became a very, very successful lawyer in Indianapolis, but again, like Manley and like all these other people, never, ever went back to Wilmington.
And they didn't spread the truth of what had actually happened?
He did. Okay. He did. And there was a black newspaper in Indianapolis, and he gave a long, long interview, which was very useful for me in my book, where he detailed, he just laid out everything that happened and tried to spread the word and tried to spread the alarm, sound the alarm.
It would be nice and it would be easy for us to sit here and think of ourselves as being superior to those people who perpetrated this travesty in 1898, but you make no bones about seeing parallels.
Yes.
To today's political climate in North Carolina. In 1898, it was Democrats fighting to minimize black influence in politics and business and society. In 2011, when Republicans took over the legislature, you point to their trying to suppress African-American votes in striking down the voter ID law.
Voter ID.
A judge said that it targeted African-Americans with almost surgical precision. We've talked about this many times on this program. On a national scale, do you consider Donald Trump's rallies and his slogan, Make America Great Again, as being on the same page with the rallies that occurred prior to, and the message that were being put out prior to what happened in Wilmington?
Absolutely. I have covered Donald Trump rallies. I covered them in 2016. They were terrifying. For one thing, he points, as you know, at the reporters and practically tells people to attack them. But his message is so similar to the message of the white supremacists. A little more subtle, not quite as openly racist. His message is, America is a white country. It's a white Christian country, and that's what we want to go back to. People of color, people of different religions, like Muslims and Hispanics, are threats to the traditional American way of life. Can I give you one quick example?
Sure.
Last summer, over and over again, on Twitter, Donald Trump said there was a Hispanic invasion of Hispanics coming in to steal your jobs and to ruin the country. Last summer in August, a white man, a gunman in El Paso at a Walmart, selected Hispanic shoppers there, killed 22 Hispanic people, and his manifesto said, I was trying to stop a Hispanic invasion.
Yeah. There were similar incidences in Memphis and New Orleans in 1866. It happened in Tulsa in 1921. It's being memorialized on HBO's The Watchmen. It happened in Illinois in 1908, in Chicago in 1919, in Atlanta in 1906. Was Wilmington the template for all these things that came afterward?
It was unique. Most of these were spontaneous outbursts of white rage, usually involving some sort of a contact between a black man and a white woman, an alleged rape, and they were sparks and they blew up. Wilmington was completely unique in that it was planned and it was premeditated over time.
Should this serve as a warning for us today?
Absolutely, particularly with the scapegoating and targeting of people of color on social media and on the internet. I see the same themes that we heard in 1898.
David Zucchino, author of Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. Thanks for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.